Thanks for tuning into the podcast. Before we start the show, I want to let you know something. My latest novel, Personal Fable, is free for the next few days. So if you're hearing this ad, it's currently free if you're a Kindle user. So just look it up on your Kindle. If you don't have a Kindle, you can even get one of those for free by getting the free Kindle app on your phone. And then head over, get Personal Fable, have a read, and if you love it, leave a review. And I hope you love the story. Now, let's get on with the podcast. P.S. The promotion runs the 11th, 12th, and 13th of March. Welcome back, Hemming Brainiacs, to the podcast talking about Long Ago and Far Away by W.H. Hudson, chapter 14. I loved the... I really liked this chapter. This was one of the better chapters so far. I loved the pigeon murder mystery, and I love the recipe. Someone should make pickled peaches. He was told that large sound fruit just ripening must be selected for pickling when the finger dents are peached, it is too ripe. The selected peaches are washed and dried and put into a cask. Then boiling vinegar with a handful of cloves is poured in until it covers the fruit. The cask is closed and left for a couple of months, by which time the fruit would be properly pickled. Davy Bones says, I never heard of pickled peaches, but there are several highly rated ones on Amazon. I might order one. Well, there's an idea. My original idea, obviously, was for someone to make it as per the recipe, which would be very cool. But if we could just buy it, yeah, that's also kind of cool. I'd love to try it. I love a good pickle. I can't say I love cold mutton or mutton in general. It's very stanky, stanky lamb. But, yeah, cool. So we must be up to chapter 15, right? Yes, indeed. Serpent and Child is the name of chapter 15. Baby update. No baby yet. But, God, must be getting close. My partner, Kylie, she's very pregnant right now. Waddling around. She's only not even at 37 weeks yet, so she's still got a few weeks left to go. But by all measurements, we are cooking a big boy. We keep getting told that he's big. We keep getting told he's going to come early. Our last measurement was about a week ago, so at about just before the 36-week mark. And he weighed, by that measurement, 3.2 kilograms, which is about where a baby is at the 39-week mark. And we were at the 35-week mark at this point. So he is 3 or 4 weeks ahead. And also, the other thing that's alarming about that is that those last few weeks of... what's it called? Gestation? Is that the word? The last few weeks of the pregnancy are when it sort of packs on the most weight, usually about 200 or 300 grams per week. So the fact that he's at the 39-week mark at 35 weeks means that by the time he's full term, he is going to be a big boy. So my partner is... You know, she's already doing all the old wives' tales of, drinking pineapple juice, bouncing up and down on a yoga ball. What else is there? Something about like raspberry leaf tea or something like that. All these like old, herbal remedies for inducing a pregnancy. She wants that thing out. So I'm on red alert here. I'm on my being kept on my toes. That any minute, any day now, we might be off to get a baby. Anyway, that's the update. Let's dive into chapter 15. It's called Serpent and Child. And it goes like this. It is not an uncommon thing, I fancy, for a child or boy to be more deeply impressed and stirred at the sight of a snake than of any other creature. This, at all events, is my experience. Birds certainly gave me more pleasure than other animals, but this too is no doubt common with children, and I take the reason of it to be not only because birds exceed in beauty, but also on account of the intensity of life they exhibit, a life so vivid, so brilliant, as to make that of other beings, such as reptiles and mammals, seem a rather poor thing by comparison. Oh, golly. But while birds were more than all other beings to me, mammals too had a great attraction. I have already spoken of rats, opossums, and armadillos, also of the vizchasha, the big burrowing rodent that made his villages all over the plain. One of my early experiences is of the tremendous outcry these animals would make at night when suddenly startled by a very loud noise, as by a clap of thunder. When we had visitors from town, especially persons new to the country who did not know the vizchasha, they would be taken out after supper, a little distance from the house, when the plain was all dark and profoundly silent, and after standing still for a few minutes to give them time to feel the silence, a gun would be discharged, and after 2 or 3 seconds the report would be followed by an extraordinary hullabaloo, a wild outcry of hundreds and thousands of voices from all over the plain for miles round, voices that seemed to come from hundreds of different species of animals, so varied they were, from the deepest moving sounds to the high shrieks and squeals of shrill-voiced birds, our visitors used to be filled with astonishment. Another animal that impressed us deeply and painfully was the skunk. They were fearless little beasts, and in the evening would come quite boldly about the house, and if seen and attacked by a dog, they would defend themselves with the awful-smelling liquid they discharged at an adversary. When the wind brought a whiff of it into the house, when all the doors and windows stood open, it would create a panic, and people would get up from table, feeling a little seasick, and go in search of some room where the smell was not. Another powerful-smelling but very beautiful creature was the common deer. I began to know it from the age of 5, when we went to our new home, and where we children were sometimes driven with our parents to visit our neighbours several miles away. There were always herds of deer on the lands where the cardoon thistle flourished most, and it was a delight to come upon them and to see their yellow figures standing among the grey-green cardoon bushes, gazing motionless at us, then turning and rushing away with a whistling cry and sending out gusts of their powerful musky smell, which the wind sometimes brought to our nostrils. But there was a something in the serpent which produced a quite different and a stronger effect on the mind than bird or mammal or any other creature. The sight of it was always startling, and however often seen, always produced a mixed sense of amazement and fear. The feeling was no doubt acquired from our elders. They regarded snakes as deadly creatures, and as a child I did not know that they were mostly harmless, that it was just as senseless to kill them as to kill harmless and beautiful birds. I was told that when I saw a snake I must turn and run for my life until I was a little bigger, and then on seeing a snake I was to get a long stick and kill it. And it was furthermore impressed on me that snakes are exceedingly difficult to kill, that many persons believe that a snake never really dies until the sun sets. Therefore, when I killed a snake in order to make it powerless to do any harm between the time of killing it and sunset, it was necessary to pound it to a pulp with the aforesaid long stick. With such teaching, it was not strange that even as a small boy I became a persecutor of snakes. Snakes were common enough about us, snakes of 7 or 8 different kinds, green in the green grass and yellow and dusky mottled in dry and barren places and in withered herbage, so that it was difficult to detect them. Sometimes they intruded into the dwelling rooms, and at all seasons a nest or colony of snakes existed in the thick old foundations of the house, and under the flooring In winter, they hibernated there, tangled together in a cluster, no doubt, and in summer, nights, when they were at home, coiled at their ease or gliding ghost-like about their subterranean apartments, I would lie awake and listen to them by the hour, for although it may be news to some closet ophiologists, serpents are not all so mute as we think them. At all events, this kind, the Philodrius aestivus, a beautiful and harmless colubrine snake, 2.5 to 3 feet long, marked all over with inky black on a vivid green ground, not only emitted a sound when lying undisturbed in his den, but several individuals would hold a conversation together which seemed endless, for I generally fell asleep before it finished. A hissing conversation, it is true, but not unmodulated, or without considerable variety in it. A long sibilation would be followed by distinctly heard ticking sounds, as of a husky ticking clock. And after 10 or 20 or 30 ticks, another hiss, like a long expiring sigh, sometimes with a tremble in it, as of a dry leaf swiftly vibrating in the wind. No sooner would one cease than another would begin, and so it would go on, demand and response, strophe and antistrophe, and at intervals several voices would unite in a kind of low, mysterious chorus, death watch and flutter and hiss, while I, lying awake in my bed, listened and trembled. It was dark in the room, and to my excited imagination, the serpents were no longer under the floor, but out, gliding hither and thither, over it with uplifted heads in a kind of mystic dance, and I often shivered to think what my bare feet might touch if I were to thrust a leg out and let it hang down over the bedside. "I am shut in a dark room with the candle blown out," pathetically cried old Farmer Fleming when he heard of his beautiful daughter Dahlia's clandestine departure to a distant land with a nameless lover. "I've heard of a sort of fear you have in that dilemma, lest you should lay your fingers on edges of sharp knives, and if I go thinking a step, and feel my way, I do cut myself, and I bleed, I do. Only in a comparatively snakeless country could such fancies be born and such metaphors used. Snakeless and highly civilized, where the blades of Sheffield are cheap and abundant. In ruder lands, where ophidians abound, as in India and South America, in the dark one fears the cold living coil and deadly sudden fang. Serpents are fearful things to me, were fearful things to me at that period, but whatsoever is terrible and dangerous, or so reported, has an irresistible attraction for the mind, whether of child or man. It was therefore always a pleasure to have seen a snake in the day's rambles, although the sight was a startling one. Also, in the warm season, it was a keen pleasure to find the cast slough of the feared and subtle creature. Here was something not the serpent, yet so much more than a mere picture of it, a dead and cast-off part of it, but in its completeness, from the segmented mask with the bright unseeing eyes, to the fine whip-like tail end, so like the serpent itself, I could handle the serpent as it were, yet be in no danger from venomous tooth or stinging tongue. True, it was colourless but silvery bright, soft as satin to the touch, crinkling when handled, with a sound that to the startled fancy recalled the dangerous living hiss from the dry rustling grass. I would clutch my prize with a fearful joy as if I had picked up a strange feather dropped in passing from the wing of one of the fallen but still beautiful angels. It always increased my satisfaction when, on exhibiting my treasure at home, the first sight of it caused a visible start or an exclamation of alarm. When my courage and strength were sufficient, I naturally began to take an active part in the persecution of serpents, for was not I also of the seed of Eve? Nor can I say when my feelings towards our bruised enemy began to change, but an incident which I witnessed at this time, when I was about 8, had, I think, a considerable influence on me. At all events, it caused me to reflect on a subject which had not previously seemed one for reflection. I was in the orchard, following in the rear of a party of grown-up persons, mostly visitors to the house, when among the foremost there were sudden screams, gestures of alarm, and a precipitate retreat. A snake had been discovered lying in the path and almost trodden upon. One of the men, the first to find a stick, or perhaps the most courageous, rushed to the front and was about to deal a killing blow when his arm was seized by one of the ladies and the blow arrested. Then, stooping quickly, she took the creature up in her hands and, going away to some distance from the others, released it in the long green grass, green in colour as its glittering skin and as cool as to the touch. Long ago as this happened, it is just as vivid to my mind as if it had just happened yesterday. I can see her coming back to us through the orchard trees, her face shining with joy because she had rescued the reptile from imminent death. Her return greeted with loud expressions of horror and amazement, which she only answered with a little laugh and the question, "Why should you kill it?" But why was she glad, so innocently glad, as it seemed to me, as if she had done some meritorious and no evil thing? My young mind was troubled at the question, and there was no answer. Nevertheless, I think that this incident bore fruit later and taught me to consider whether it might not be better to spare than to kill, better not only for the animal spared, but for the soul. And the woman who did this unusual thing, and in doing it unknowingly dropped a minute seed into a boy's mind, who was she? Perhaps it would be as well to give a brief account of her, although I thought that I had finished with the subject of our neighbours. She and her husband, a man named Matthew Blake, were our second nearest English neighbours. They lived a good deal further than the Royds and were seldom visited by us. To me, there was nothing interesting in them and their surroundings, as they had no family and no people but the native peons about them, and above all, no plantation where birds could be seen. They were typical English people of the lower middle class who read no books and conversed with considerable misuse of the aspirate about nothing but their own and their neighbours' affairs. Physically, Mr. Blake was a very big man, being 6'3" in height and powerfully built. He had a round, ruddy face, clean shaven except for a pair of side whiskers, and pale blue shallow eyes. He was invariably dressed in black cloth, his garments being homemade and too large for him, the baggy trousers thrust into his long boots. Mr. Blake was nothing to us but a huge, serious, somewhat silent man who took no notice of small boys and was clumsy and awkward and spoke very bad Spanish. He was well spoken by his neighbours, and was regarded as a highly respectable and dignified person, but he had no intimates, and was one of those fortunate persons, not rare among the English, who appear to stand behind a wall, and whether they desire it or not, have no power to approach and mix with their fellow beings. I think he was about 45 to 50 years old when I was 8. His wife looked older, and was a short, ungraceful woman with a stoop, wearing a sunbonnet and sack and a faded gown made by herself. Her thin hair was of a yellowish-grey tint, her eyes pale blue, and there was a sunburnt redness on her cheeks, but the face had a faded and weary look. But she was better than her giant husband, and was glad to associate with her fellows, and was also a lover of animals, horses, dogs, cats, and every wild creature that came in her way. The Blakes had been married a quarter of a century or longer, and had spent at least 20 years of their childless, solitary life in a mud-built ranch, sheep farming on the pampas, and had slowly accumulated a small fortune until now they were possessed of about a square league of land with 25,000 or 30,000 sheep, and had built themselves a big, ugly brick house to live in. They had thus secured the prize for which they had gone so many thousands of miles and had toiled for so many years, but they were certainly not happy. Poor Mr. Blake, cut off from his fellow creatures by that wall that stood before him, had found companionship in the bottle, and was seen less and less by his neighbours. And when his wife came to us to spend 2 or 3 days for a change, although her home was only a couple of hours' ride away, the reason probably was that her husband was in one of his bouts and made the place intolerable to her. I remember that she always came to us with a sad, depressed look on her face, but after a few hours would recover her spirits and grow quite cheerful and talkative. And of an evening there was music. She would sometimes consent, after some persuasion, to give the company a song. That was a joy to us youngsters, as she had a thin, cracked voice that always, at the high notes, went off into a falsetto. Her favourite air was Home Sweet Home, and her rendering in her wailing, cracked voice was as great a feast to us as the strange laugh of our grotesque neighbour, Gandara. And that is all I can say about her. But now, when I remember that episode of the snake in the orchard, it looks to me not unbeautiful in memory, and her voice in the choir, invisible, sounds sweet enough. And that is the chapter. Cool. All right. Great stuff, folks. Thanks for listening. Catch you tomorrow.